Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulubi. This week on Culturetopia, a backstage look at a surprise musical sensation, The Book of Mormon, brought to Broadway via the creators of South Park. Angry Birds, the frighteningly addictive iPhone app, has gone Hollywood with a new game developed with 20th Century Fox. And an interview with the author of a new book called Damn You Autocorrect, about the best of the worst in mistexts. But first,
among the casualties of Egypt's revolution are many of its famous historical sites and artifacts. Vandalism and looting skyrocketed in the weeks after Egyptian police, including those responsible for tourism and protecting antiquities, vanished from their posts. Even now, as security forces resume their duties, archaeologists and experts complain that more needs to be done by Egypt's new government to protect the country's heritage. NPR's Soraya Sarhadi Nelson reports that Cairo's Egyptian Museum suffered some of the worst damage.
Life is slowly returning to normal at this museum that is home to famous ancient Egyptian artifacts like the golden mask of the boy king, Tutankhamun.
The mummy of King Tutankhamun was placed inside of a coffin out of pure gold.
Tourists who are slowly returning see few signs of the damage and looting that took place here in late January.
Sorry.
But Deputy Museum Director Mahmoud El-Helwagi says it feels like it happened yesterday. The veteran curator cringes when he recounts the events. The ruling party's headquarters next door was set ablaze. Thousands of protesters flooded nearby Tahrir Square and clashed with the police. They in turn fled. El-Helwagi says the chaos provided the perfect cover for the thieves and vandals who climbed onto the museum roof.
The looters were able to come down from this window with the cable, electric cable, and one of them were fall down on this showcase and it was broken and he was injured, and we found his blood on the floor and still remains on the artifacts.
He pauses at another glass display case he says was one of 13 that had to be replaced.
This showcase was broken, and now, as you see, this is a new glass. There was artifacts like these, similar was here.
He points to a painted wooden statue inside, one of King Tut astride a leopard. A second one is no longer there, he says.
I think they thought that this is gold.
The King Tut was
gold. Yeah, because it's gilded wood.
Frustrated, the thieves smashed it, then continued their search for gold and jewelry inside the museum, El-Helwagi says. They got none, he adds, because those items were locked behind iron gates the thieves couldn't break through. El-Helwagi says the broken statue is being restored in the museum's laboratory. He adds a teenaged protester brought back a 16-inch limestone statue that he found laying outside in Tahrir Square. During the unrest, civilian volunteers who feared for the museum formed a human cordon around the building, despite the risks of being in the volatile square, says Faiza Haeckel, a professor of Egyptology at the American University in Cairo.
The people, the citizens, organized themselves to protect their antiquities. And this is not only in the Cairo Museum, but in many places in Egypt it happened.
The Egyptian military also stepped in, taking over law enforcement and eventually the leadership of the country. But Haeckel and others say there simply weren't enough soldiers to protect all of Egypt's antiquities and sites. Even with the police returning, experts complain that looting continues, especially from storerooms at Egypt's many remote ancient monuments and digs. Egypt's antiquities chief quit in protest over the transitional government's failure to address the issue. Another top official, museum director Tarek Alawadi, says he drafted a petition signed by thousands of archaeologists worldwide who are demanding that the Egyptian government make protecting the country's historical sites and antiquities a top priority.
This heritage should be protected by everyone in Egypt and outside Egypt, because this is for the whole world. It's the heritage of mankind.
A UNESCO team is reported to be in Egypt this week to assess the damage and offer help. Soraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News, Cairo.
I'm Robert Siegel.
Robert, I'm going to be with you in just a second. I'm just trying to finish this game of Angry Birds here.
She's Melissa Black.
I am.
Yeah,
I'm a little distracted right now.
Yeah. Angry Birds.
Angry Birds. An addictive game that I'm playing on my iPhone right now.
A game that has been downloaded 100 million downloads in 15 months?
Angry Birds. It is the most downloaded app ever, Robert. Yeah. And all you do is you pull a slingshot bag. You catapult this Angry Bird. toward a crowd of ornery green pigs. I missed.
And no birds and no pigs were harmed in the making
of
that game. Angry Birds has a new version out. It was created by a small company in Finland that's become the envy of the entertainment business.
And NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports that it's helping 20th Century Fox promote a new animated movie, Rio.
First, why are they angry?
The birds are angry because the pigs steal their eggs.
Peter Mighty Eagle Vesterbacka of Rovio, the makers of Angry Birds.
You know, if somebody would steal your eggs, you would be really angry too.
The physics-based game is addictive. Getting the arc off the catapult just right.
It looks pretty simple, but it's pretty hard to master.
Andrew Stalbo is Senior Vice President of Mobile for 20th Century Fox. He thinks Rovio got everything right with Angry Birds. The degree of difficulty, the fact that it appeals to both kids and adults, the marketing.
They've created these kind of adorable little videos that just spread virally across social networks. And it's something that we really aspire to in terms of the games that we've created here at Fox.
The American behemoth, 20th Century Fox, wanted something from this little company in Finland. So Stalbo and another Fox executive flew to Helsinki. They showed Peter Vesterbacka and the team at Rovio clips of their new movie, Rio, which is also about birds.
Oh, how I wish I was back in my cage with my mirror and my little bell.
Bobo here can't fly.
Don't worry, Blue. It's in your DNA.
Our creative people really, really liked what they saw.
So Rovio agreed to create a new game featuring the Angry Birds and the exotic birds from Rio. Now remember, Angry Birds has been downloaded over 100 million times. Fox would be thrilled to get that audience for Rio. Plus, a lot of those gamers are not moviegoers.
There will be a lot of people that will go and see this that wouldn't normally maybe take their time to go and see a movie. So it's going to be very, very interesting to see.
And what's in it for the Angry Birds?
The marketing power that we could bring to promote the new game on the platforms.
Billboards, posters, a hidden code in a Super Bowl commercial.
From the creators of Ice Age.
Welcome to Rio!
A bird who never learned to fly.
It's hard to say who has more to gain from the Fox-Rovio partnership. The Angry Birds got a free ride in an expensive Super Bowl ad, and Rio might reach a whole new audience when its birds are part of the massively popular video game. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Our computers and smartphones have an almost limitless power to embarrass us. Say you write an email or a text message and your computer or smartphone doesn't quite send out what you wanted. Pop culture blogger Jillian Madison has collected hundreds of unintended text messages in her book, Damn You, Autocorrect! Awesomely embarrassing text messages you didn't mean to send. We invited her, along with the linguist Ben Zimmer, who runs the website Visual Thesaurus, into our New York studios, and they spoke with Renee about how autocorrect goes awry.
I want to start with you, Jillian. You've received hundreds of copies of autocorrected text messages a day. What are the most common word changes?
First of all, I would have to say, ha ha, you know, laughing. That turns into Shabaka, who is actually an Egyptian pharaoh.
Oh. So that could be a learning experience.
Yes, it can. Another really popular one is hell. It turns into heel, H-E apostrophe L-L, which is the bane of a lot of people's existence.
Also, pick me up can turn to oil me
oil
up.
Oil me up, yes. That's always interesting. And kids turn into LSD as well. So if you you say, I'm going to run out and pick up the kids, it often turns into, I'm going to run out and pick up the LSD. I'll be home in a little while.
Let's talk about some more of these text messages that you've collected in the book. But first, I want to just, Ben, ask you, what is the history of spell check when it comes to smartphones? And what's the technical thing that's going on there?
There are definitely predecessors going back to the automatic spell checking from Microsoft Word and other word processing programs. This has really exploded into a new phenomenon since the introduction of smartphones that use these virtual keyboards. And suddenly we have millions of people trying to tap out messages on these phones. And we also have a relatively new technology of trying to understand what the users mean. So it does it by both auto-correcting, sometimes just based on the proximity of letters on the keyboard. It's going to make the best guess of what letters you meant to type. And then it also does a kind of an auto-complete. But that leads to problems like, for instance, one of Jillian's examples. If you're talking about Derek Jeter, the baseball player, spelled J-E-T-E-R, well, if his name isn't in the dictionary, it's both going to guess that perhaps that J should have been an H, and it'll also try to complete the word, and you'll end up with heterosexual. So completely different from what you meant to type, even if you were typing it correctly.
There's one text message that changed Disney, pretty innocent, into divorce. Why don't you read us that one?
I believe it was a father was talking to his daughter, and he said, your mom and I are going to divorce next month. Hannah, the girl who received the text message, she said, what? What do you mean you're going to divorce? What's going on? And the father said, Disney. I wrote Disney. We're going to Disney, not to divorce. So the poor daughter almost had a heart attack there.
I have to say, reading some of these, they make, in a way, some kind of sense and in some kind of poetic sense. Grandpa bought me a corn dog from the devil. From the devil is the response. And then, wow, deli, ha, ha, ha. You know, I meant deli. Well, deli, devil, that makes sense. But we can't even talk about quite a few of those in this collection of texts because, I mean, simply put, autocorrect has its mind in the gutter.
Absolutely. I say autocorrect has a mind of its own, and it's often a very dirty mind.
But why do you think?
Well, the ones that are funniest, of course, are the ones that are just so hilariously inappropriate. So there's a kind of self-selection going on with the ones that Jillian is receiving to Damn You Autocorrect. Of course, they're going to be the ones that are the dirtiest, the most risque. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think it also says something about the sociology of these situations. You know, you're texting with your parents or co-workers or loved ones. And there's a whole sort of panoply of new embarrassing situations that you can find yourself in so that when one of those extremely embarrassing words slips through, it can create this fraught situation in the social relationship there.
And it's so much more embarrassing, you know, telling your boss that you'll be aroused later instead of maybe around later. When you say something like that to your boss, there's that whole new level of mortifying that sets in.
Ben, what is your advice for people who use text messaging frequently? I mean, should they just turn off the autocorrect function if it starts to become a problem?
Well, that's one solution. You can just turn it off, but it learns from your own behavior, so it does get better over time. And so I would say, you know, if you're using it, just be careful, obviously, before you hit that send button to just take a quick look, especially if you're talking to your boss or your parents, just to make sure that you're not setting out the wrong thing. And when wrong things do show up, try to have a good laugh about it. Maybe even learn some new vocabulary. If hilarious changes to hooscow, you can learn a new slang term for prison. If holy moly changes to holy molybdenum, you can learn the name of an element on the periodic table.
That's linguist Ben Zimmer and Jillian Madison, who blogs at Pop Hangover. Her book, Damn You, Autocorrect, comes out today. You can find more embarrassing text messages from Jillian's book at npr.org.
Conflict is the basis of drama, and the divide between Israelis and Palestinians contain all of the elements of it, passion, conviction, courage, and conflict. A new film, Morale, tells the story of an orphaned Palestinian girl who gets drawn into that conflict.
I have to deal with the Israelis every day. You have to think. Prudence is the most precious virtue.
You don't understand anything. If you were me, you would be out there too. This is our struggle.
Listen, girl. This school is the difference between you and the children in the refugee camp. This is your chance, Meral. Don't lose it.
Meral is directed by Julian Schnabel. He joins us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott. It's my pleasure to be here.
Give us a sense, Mr. Schnabel. Frida Pinto there playing Meral. Of course, Frida Pinto, best known probably for her role in Slumdog Millionaire. Young girl and her passionate verbal confrontation with the woman who is the head of the orphanage.
That was actually Iyam Abbas, who was playing her teacher, Hind Husseini.
What kind of story did you want to tell through Miral's eyes?
It's not just Miral's story, but it's also the story of other women at different moments in time through Miral's eyes that have gone through the conflict and their different ways of dealing with it. Some survive, some don't. But I thought it was important to tell this story through the point of view of a young Palestinian girl. It's as if it was her diary. That was my goal, to be true to that point of view.
I don't have to tell you how much controversy surrounds this film as it opens. We had Harvey Weinstein on our show a couple of weeks ago. His company is distributing the film. Harvey describes the film as pro-Palestinian in the sense that it tells a story from the narrative viewpoint of a sympathetic Palestinian character. Here's what Harvey Weinstein said.
You know, I don't understand why this movie should have the kind of, you know, backlash that it's having, but it should be embraced because you will never understand the Middle East unless you embrace that culture too. And I think one of the problems about the Middle East is that the Palestinian conflict has lingered too long. We need to find the solution. This is an open window into that. And it's also a hell of a good story. I'm not running a documentary on this movie. It's not polemical in that way. You will watch a story that will entertain and move you.
Now, of course, voices ranging from the American Jewish Committee to the Anti-Defamation League to Harvey Weinstein's mother, as he volunteered to us, have voiced objections to the film. They say it caricatures Israelis and ignores their true life stories of being attacked and defamed. I wonder what sort of answer you give.
Well, first of all, there are many Jewish groups that actually have stepped up and rebutted the negativity and said that they're very happy that this movie is made and reinforced Joseph Dice's decision to show this, who was the president of the General Assembly, at the United Nations. And so I think that there is conflict in between the Jewish community also. My sister, who was the president of Hadassah, my mother was in 1948, but my sister Andrea was at the screening at the United Nations, and she was extremely proud and thought it was extremely constructive. So I think it's about empathy, this film, and hearing the other side, being able to hear the other side, is considering that there is something that needs to be solved. It is the diary of this girl. Does this girl get to have her portrait painted? Or do I need to paint a portrait of an Israeli girl also?
Of course, we should point out the film is inspired by the life, really, of the author and screenwriter Ruta Jibril. I hate the term girlfriend, but can we refer to her as your girlfriend?
At the time when I started working on this, she wasn't, and I came to it not because she was my girlfriend, but because I read her book and I thought that it was a story that could make a good movie. And I thought, as a Jewish man from New York City, it would be exponentially more interesting, or it had some kind of impact if I would tell that story.
Speaking with artist and filmmaker Julian Schnabel about his new movie, Miral. Did you take, as some people have suggested, some creative license with the scene where Miral is treated brutally by Israeli police?
I softened things up a bit because I didn't want to see her back when Miral is being hit with a cane, or her face, so there's a black hood over her face. And so, yes, there's some license taken in there not to show actually her back being hit with a stick where she would have scars on her back, which she does.
You're talking about Ruta Jibril has scars on her back.
She does.
Yeah. Inflicted by an Israeli policeman.
Yes. But that being said, I think that she loves the state of Israel. One thing that struck me, I mean, she's Israeli and she's Palestinian. And I think what people don't realize also, if we're talking about Jewish people thinking that it doesn't portray Jewish people or Israeli people in a good light, I mean, we're showing a Palestinian stepfather raping his daughter. We're showing Palestinian people killing Hani, who is deciding that he wants to be involved in the peace process. Mm-hmm. If anybody has ever seen Before Night Falls or The Diving Bell and the Butterfly or Basquiat, they might be curious just how I told the story, because I don't think that you can separate the story from how it's told.
Well, help us understand that. Those films that you mentioned, Diving Bell and the Butterfly, Basquiat, Before Night Falls, are often, or have often been called biopics.
You can use that word, but I think that sells them short in a way.
Yeah.
I think they're more like they're portraits of people, filmic portraits. Mm-hmm. Things are told in the first person, and I think when you watch the film The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, you are inside of Jean-Dominique Bauby's skin. You're in his body. You are paralyzed, except your imagination is not, and you are participating in his situation. You're not watching it from a distance. I guess all the films are made in the first person, so if you can describe that better than me, you could kind of talk about your feeling when you saw those films, or if you saw those films.
I think portrait's a good phrase. Maybe a series of vignettes might not be a bad way of putting it.
Mm-hmm. I think also people have looked at my films as episodic in a negative way at the beginning, and I think after making a few of them, people understood that was my style, or that's my storytelling technique. By the time Miral arrives in the movie, you know why she's doing something, because you seen what her mother did, you saw what her aunt did, you saw what the landscape was before she ever arrived. And I thought that was an interesting way to tell a story also.
You shot this movie in Jerusalem, didn't you?
I shot the movie in Jerusalem and in Ramallah and in Akko and in Ramleh and Jaffa and Haifa, yes.
And what was that like? And I gather a lot of Israeli technicians on the crew, too.
Absolutely. We had Israeli technicians and Palestinian crew members, and people worked together because they believe that this is about peace, and they all want that. It was very, very heartwarming and instructive and constructive at the same time. The mayor of Jerusalem was extremely helpful, and I was able to close where the Lion's Gate is to shoot up to the Muslim cemetery. And the people that run the Al-Aqsa Mosque let me shoot inside of the mosque. When you see the Husseini house where the children are brought after Hind finds them in 1948, it's brought to the house that actually was the Hind Husseini house. Mm-hmm. And so in my search for authenticity, I think I found people that really, really helped me.
Julian Schnabel, film director and artist, talking about his new film, Miral, and speaking from our studios in New York. Thanks so much.
Scott, thank you so much.
The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has worked hard to get the Book of Mormon to all corners of the globe. But tonight, the book goes to a place it has never been before, at least not like this. It's the Broadway premiere of the new musical, The Book of Mormon. The show was not written or endorsed by the church. It is a searing comedy from the team behind South Park. NPR's Robert Smith reports that the production is probably the most offensive yet sweetest show on Broadway.
As any South Park fan can tell you, Trey Parker and Matt Stone have an obsession with Mormons.
Mormonism sort of just been the little thing that's always fascinated us the most.
Hi, hi! Welcome to heaven, brother. You followed the Mormon faith, and so you've been let in.
We've got cookies and punch, and we're just about to start playing charades.
Since it is an example of a religion that we have that's American and that's young and that we can kind of look at and say, why did this catch on, you know?
There goes that kooky Joseph Smith. You know, he claims he spoke with God and Jesus.
Well, how do you know he didn't? Dum, dum, dum,
dum, dum. On South Park and in their movies, the Mormon bit characters always come off as super nice and a little gullible. And as Parker and Stone were trying to create a Broadway musical, they realized that the stage was the perfect place to give their Mormon characters a star turn.
Mormons give you such an excuse to be cheesy and Rodgers and Hammerstein again, you know, because you can have Mormons dancing around and doing things and being super optimistic, and people don't just go, well, that's not real, because it's like, yeah, it's real. We're talking about Mormons.
Perhaps you could tell by the laughter that Parker and Stone are not Mormon. Neither is their collaborator, Bobby Lopez. When people found out that three of the wickedest, funniest minds in the business were working on an adaptation of the Book of Mormon, there was definitely a sense of foreboding. Were they really going to take a sacred text and mock it on stage for $100 a ticket?
we don't hate Mormons. So we weren't ever going to set out to make this two-hour-long Mormon bashing. We really set out to create a very traditional musical in a lot of ways.
The Book of Mormon on Broadway is a classic odd couple slash fish-out-of-water story. Two Utah missionaries are sent to a remote village in Uganda. One is the perfect Mormon, convinced that with charm and faith, he can convert a whole continent. The other missionary is a screw-up who hasn't even made it all the way through the scriptures. Now, this is normally the point in the NPR story where I would play you a little bit of the music from the Book of Mormon, but that's not going to happen. The producers of the musical have taken the unusual step of not releasing any sound from the show. They think that the jokes would be too vulgar out of context. But I kind of want to give you the flavor of the show. You know how in The Lion King, there's that big jungle number? In the Book of Mormon musical, there's a similar song. It's called Hasadega Ibawai. The missionaries dance, along with the Ugandans, until they discover what those words mean. The villagers are actually telling God what he can go do to himself. In graphic terms, we've had no rain in several days, Hasadega Ibawai. 80% of us have AIDS, Hasadega Ibawai. Yeah, maybe the producers were right. There's so much in this musical to be offended by. There are jokes about cancer, domestic violence, child abuse. There is a running gag about female circumcision. There's a big dance number set in hell with Jeffrey Dahmer, Johnny Cochran, and two forbidden cups of Starbucks coffee. And yet, there is this innocent Mormon streak that runs through the whole musical. Do you remember how in The Little Mermaid, Ariel dreams of going up onto land? In the Book of Mormon, there's a similar song with a young Ugandan girl, only she dreams of her own version of utopia, Salta Leka City. She sings, I bet the people are open-minded, accepting, and free of sin, and all I hope is that when I find it, I'm able to fit in. And the audience just melts. In the end, the least offensive part of this musical might just be the way they treat the Mormon faith. I even brought a member of the LDS Church to a preview, just to make sure I wasn't imagining it.
Hi, my name's Elna Baker, the token Mormon.
She's also a writer and a comedian living in New York City. Baker laughed along through the entire show, especially at the insider jokes about Mormon doctrine.
Like, it was a checklist of all these things that are very particular to Mormon beliefs, and they nailed every single one of them.
They skewer the story of Joseph Smith digging up the golden plates. They take a couple of pot shots at the Mormon doctrine that kept blacks out of the priesthood until 1978.
There's a line where they say, I believe that God lives on a planet called Kolob. That is an actual Mormon belief. We do believe that, but taken out of context, or even in context, you do not want anyone to know that you actually believe it.
But here's where the sweetness comes in. The Mormons in the musical embrace every quirk of their faith. It makes them stronger. And in the end, the audience who laughed at them is actually won over.
I think it teaches you about how if the whole world is sort of against you or against your ideas, what it requires of you to still believe those things.
Now, Elna Baker wants to make this clear. Many Mormons, including her mom, would never make it to the end of this musical. They'd walk out after the first few F words. And the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is not protesting the show. They released a simple statement. The production may attempt to entertain audiences for an evening, it says. But the Book of Mormon, as a volume of scripture, will change people's lives forever by bringing them closer to Christ. Matt Stone and Trey Parker thought that was just brilliant.
Every time we do something with Mormons, their response makes us like them more.
Robert Smith, NPR News, New York.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.